meditating serenely. I'm not mad. Makes no difference where I go. You're the best hometown I know. Hello, Calgary. Hello, Calgary. You know we love you. Makes no difference where I go. You're the best hometown I know. Welcome to the Alberta Advantage. We've assembled today to discuss the death of the median voter. I'm your host, Kate Jacobson, and around the table today we have Joel.
Hello, hello.
Karen.
Hey, everyone.
And Rory.
Hi there.
So what is this median voter business and why bother talking about it? Well, you see, the median voter theorem is what is at the basis of a lot of political science and a lot of political strategy. It's been what's informed political campaigning for the majority of the post-war years, and it's rapidly showing itself to be flawed and limited in some very, very important places. Think of the election of populist leaders and some populist results, giving us outcomes that, quote, no one could have seen coming. Things like Brexit, the election of Trump, the rise of Jeremy Corbyn, even the 2015 election of Alberta's NDP could all be considered in this category. So, to begin with, what is the median voter theory?
Basically, the idea that political parties and candidates earn their victories over a struggle for the middle ground.
So if you were to imagine a graph, and the graph has both an x-axis and a y-axis, your left-wing candidate represents the range of left opinion on the left side of the graph, and your right-wing candidate represents the range of right-wing opinion on the right side of the graph. And in the middle of the graph is a nice big bell curve that basically has tails, and these tails trail off to either side. And the idea is that the further you are from widely received public opinion, which is congregated in the middle of the graph under this bell curve, the less votes there is to get. And as you go farther to the left and farther to the right, there's going to be less and less people who are going to be attracted to your messaging.
Yeah, so the more outside the norm or outside of the middle ground of the curve, the more you stick out your opinions like away from that very center of the bell curve, the more you risk basically getting annihilated.
You end up with parties kind of mimicking each other with mild differences between them. Just as sellers in a free market try to win over their competitors' customers by making slight changes to improve their product, so too do politicians deviate only slightly from their opponent's platform so as to gain votes.
So this model has some major assumptions. It assumes most people vote. It assumes most people agree what the big central defining issues are and have committed political identities that line up with these issues.
A classic example of political issues existing on this spectrum in really, really well-defined ways is maybe something like abortion or gay marriage, where there is in your mind, as soon as I say those things, a really clear left-wing position on those issues and a really clear right-wing position on those issues. And they kind of more or less track with what people who consider themselves to be left-wing or right-wing would think about them.
Although it's interesting, there's not really a middle ground, like a median voter on abortion. It's like either you're for it or you're against it. You're not really like in between. So you don't have the parties like competing for that middle ground of people who want some abortions, but not all abortions.
You will get like, you will see centrist politicians say like, oh, I'm against abortion, but make really qualified, like, oh no, I want the like only medically necessary ones, or you know, like these really tortured arguments.
I would actually argue that you rarely see people come out outside of the left wing of the spectrum and say abortion is a medical procedure and it is a good without qualifying it. Instead, you get like, yeah, these very tortured arguments about like, well, like I personally would never get an abortion, but I think it should be available to others, and so on. Other assumptions of this model are that it assumes that radicals on each wing of this spectrum of opinion, those tails that trail off the bell curve, have nowhere else to go. So it basically assumes that if you are far left or far right, that you are stuck voting for the candidate that approximates their position but is close to the center.
Basically, where you're voting Democrat or Republican or liberal and conservative, you have two choices. And if you're like very left wing, you have to vote for the liberals because you don't have an option. And if you're very right wing, then the conservatives are your only option. But as you can see from actual politics, that's not really the case.
It also assumes that what really determines elections are these nebulous swing voters that live in the middle of this bell curve, because that is where the majority of the votes are.
Also, according to the median voter theorem, third parties rarely, if ever, win elections for these kinds of same reasons. Basically, if you look at the extremes of either end of the tail, major parties will co-opt the platforms of minor parties in order to secure more votes. And this is something you see in Canada with the Liberal Party kind of stealing from the New Democrat platform every once in a while.
And the last major assumption that makes median voter theory is the idea that what really determines elections are these nebulous swing voters that live in the middle of this bell curve, and that is where most of the votes are, and parties are trying to win the most of the votes. And for the most part, if you take all of these assumptions to be true, median voter theory actually makes a lot of sense. But what we are seeing right now is that the assumptions behind this theory are really less and less in play. So to start with, the idea that most people vote, how true is that?
The idea that most people vote has a problematic history, particularly in Canada and particularly in Alberta. Voter turnout in Canada from the 50s up until the 80s was usually somewhere around the 75% mark, you know, up or down a few points. The 1990s saw it drop below the 70% mark. So you had voter turnout hovering in the range of between 60 and 70%. In Alberta, voter turnouts, like, these are incredible, and so I just love to spout them off. In 1993, you saw 60% voter turnout, and that elected Ralph Klein. In 1997, you saw 53% turnout. That was Klein again. In 2001, you had 53% turnout. That elected Klein again. In 2004, you had 45% turnout. Like, less than half the eligible voters turned out, elected Klein again. In 2008, in what I think was an Alberta record, 40% of eligible voters turned out, and that was Ed Stelmach's big election. In 2012, you had 54% turnout. That was when the Wildrose became the official opposition. In 2015, when the NDP got elected, you saw 57% turnout. And then in the most recent election that saw Jason Kenney elected, you saw 64% turnout.
And one of the most staggering facts about the last election, actually, is that in this most recent election, where Jason Kenney was elected premier, 265,880 more people voted for the UCP than voted for the combined PC Wildrose vote in 2015. So that is a massive number of people that didn't vote for either of the conservative parties last time. So these are either new voters or there are people who are switching from voting for the NDP to voting for the United Conservative Party.
Even more surprising is it's not so much that voters abandoned the NDP, because the NDP got 14,631 more votes than they did in 2015. And lost the election pretty badly. So basically, they got more votes than an election that they won, but lost it because, like, you had a huge turnout of people who hadn't voted.
So if you do some incredibly rough and not very rigorous back of the envelope math on this, you look at these increased vote totals from 2015 to 2019, and of all of this increase in votes, the NDP only got 5% of that increase in voter turnout. You can really see how they lost the election when you look at numbers like that.
It's important to think about these non-voters that are coming to vote and how that's affecting what's happening. When you think about the UCP and all the votes that they got from non-voters compared to the previous election, that increase in votes that they got accounts for 14% of all votes cast, or 8.9% of the voter turnout. When you think about it in the case of the NDP and the extra votes that they got, that increase accounts for 0.7% of ballots cast, or 0.5% of the voter turnout. So the UCP managed to just, like, turn out, I mean, it's incredible. It's like more than 250,000 people.
Yeah.
Impressive.
Yeah.
You do not, under any circumstances, gotta hand it to them.
So you can see when elections are decided by those who don't usually vote, the assumptions about the median voter theory just go out the window. So in these contexts, victory goes to the politician who can draw the disenfranchised into the political arena, even if it's temporary and based on extravagant or unfulfilled promises.
And this is exactly Jason Kenney's campaign, and this is exactly Jason Kenney's tactic. Think about bringing back the Alberta advantage.
We're already here.
Yeah, we've come
been
on.
Here the whole time.
Wow.
Or magically bringing jobs to Alberta through corporate tax cuts. These are not things that are real. These are not things that are going to happen. They are based in absolutely nothing. And yet they are bringing disenfranchised voters into politics and into voting for Jason Kenney. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why this could have been just general dissatisfaction with the way things are, hatred for the NDP, falling prey to these corporate media narratives about the Notley-Trudeau alliance or whatever the fuck has been made up in the past 5 years, racism. Like, there's so many reasons that could lead people to these things.
All the ideological work the oil industry has done over the decades to inculcate Albertans with a sense that the oil industry interest is exactly the same as the public interest, and nobody doing anything to say that's actually not the case.
So they're happy when your oil boss gets a tax cut, but not realizing that those are the ones who laid you off in the first place.
So let's compare that strategy of like going after the disenfranchised with what, you know, what did the NDP do during that campaign?
I always voted PC. My parents voted PC. My grandparents voted PC. We're a conservative family. My dad always voted for Peter Lougheed. 4 years ago, I voted for Jim Prentice because I supported the party, and I thought he was a good man. But Jason Kenney, these issues with the truth, with what he says he wants to do, he worries me. And these people who are with him, I don't agree with everything Rachel Notley has done, but at least with her, she says what she means, and she means what she says. Jason Kenney, I just don't think that's the way to go this time.
Wow, I can't believe that didn't work.
I want to die.
Yeah, so there's a lot wrong with that. But in particular, the strategy behind it is like, let's go after all those PC voters that are like dissatisfied or don't trust Jason Kenney. Like, how is that a giant base of voters that you want to get?
Because there's only a limited pool of people who could possibly vote. And so you have to micro target them with very nuanced messages that make them stop in their tracks and think, I'm going to take a second out of my busy day to just think and talk about this and then come to a reasonable conclusion.
Rachel Notley, at least she means what she says. If all you can say about the person at the head of your party starts with at least, that might not be great.
So obviously the mechanics of that ad, there's tons wrong with it. But what I find so stunning about it is that they're going after like these old school like PC voters who are like a dying breed or of like max like half the committed conservative base, like if given the Wildrose PC split. How is that just a giant mass of people that you really want to target?
People who have positive nostalgia for Peter Lougheed. How many people is that?
Not a lot. Like, just think about the demographics of like population growth in Alberta over the past few decades. Most of those people come from not Alberta. And so why would they know anything about Peter Lougheed or like be able to like summon within themselves their deep and rich history of the like progressive conservative dynasty in Alberta? How does that speak to anybody?
People were sick of the progressive conservative dynasty in 2015, which is why they threw them out.
Well, I mean, this goes back to just a massive problem with the NDP, which is that they got elected by defeating the progressive conservatives. And then we're like, we should act like the progressive conservatives, who famously people love.
They bought into this median voter theorem, essentially, which are like, now we're the center. We're going to chase these center votes. And
how Kenny and the UCP engaged like these disenfranchised voters is through what was fundamentally conspiracy theory. They used this whole narrative around foreign-funded environmental activists blocking the oil industry from being able to build pipelines and get our product to market, et cetera, et cetera. This, if you actually look at it empirically, it has no real foundation, particularly when you've got Vivian Krause arguing that it's the U.S. oil industry is trying to strangle the Canadian oil industry to protect its own profit margins, which makes no sense because the U.S. oil industry is historically and still is heavily invested in Canadian oil development. UCP then painted this idea of the Notley-Trudeau alliance to like destroy Alberta, which is also really farcical because Trudeau bought a pipeline for Alberta, $4.5 billion to buy a 60-year-old pipeline and however many more billions of dollars it's going to cost to twin the thing. But this was very effective at getting people out and motivated to vote because people want the boom times back, and the NDP wasn't really offering a great argument as to what they were going to do, but the UCP was saying, like, this is exactly what we're going to do.
And the success of this is built upon all of these core assumptions that are baked into our society and that have to be politically contested to be changed. So it's baked upon settler colonial ideas of environmentalists, which is, of course, very often a dog whistle for Indigenous people. It's based upon this idea that Rory mentioned earlier, that what is good for the oil industry is good for Alberta, this type of symbolic nationalization of what are privately owned corporations that are making a very small group of people incredibly rich. And the thing is if you want people not to fall prey to these types of conspiracy theories and narratives, you have to change political assumptions. which means you have to do politics, which means you can't just be chasing these political assumptions that already exist and form the basis of this median voter theorem.
The second assumption that is falling apart is that this assumption that most people agree on what the big central and defining issues are and have committed political identities that line up with those issues.
I think one of the best examples of this is Brexit. And I think of both the failure and the inability of the Parliamentary Labour Party to stake out a clear position on Brexit. And that's because being for or against Brexit does not fall along neat party lines, is you absolutely have members of both the Conservatives and the Labour Party who are very strongly for leave, and you have members of those same parties that are very strongly for remain. And there are so many reasons you could be in the Labour Party and be for Brexit, for example. You could be for Brexit because of xenophobia. You could be for Brexit because you see the EU as an agent of austerity that is only going to ensure that Britain can never actually complete any projects of socialist transformation. You could be from an area that has been severely deindustrialized, and you could be taken in by these ideologies and narratives of economic nationalism. There are so many things that are at play there. And then again, you could be a member of the Labour Party and you could be like, the EU is a really important transformative project, or you could say, freedom of movement is really, really important for me. So there are so many things going on there, and just a complete inability to actually say this is the left position on it or this is the right position on it.
The other example of 2016 that's used as this sort of like collapse of like political normality is the Trump election. So what we know and love and hate about Trump as this weird, bizarre guy who somehow is president of the United States, and I still can't believe it sometimes, but he did everything that you're not supposed to do in order, and then still got elected. So he proposed things that were outside of the normal American political spectrum, which is economic nationalism, because typically both parties have been very much in favor of like further free trade. But Trump said, no, I want to tear up NAFTA. I want to tear up the Trans-Pacific Partnership and all these other like free trade deals, or force like renegotiations of them. And this is quite popular because obviously, thanks to free trade, you've had like a lot of deindustrialization in the United States. And this has impacted a lot of people who historically would have been like workers who would have been unionized and the base of the Democrats. So in 2016, a lot of those people just stayed home. They checked out because the Democrats offered nothing to them. And some of them flipped and voted for Trump. I mean, to be honest, Trump's base is still mostly like what is historically the Republican base. But Trump and his opponent, Clinton, were basically suppressed a lot of the Democratic vote. So Trump won very, very narrowly. But he also represented what was happening already. Like he isn't the one who actually broke politics. If you look at like congressional elections in the decade prior to this, like Americans hate Congress. It's like less than 20% of Americans trust Congress, yet 96% of them get reelected every single time.
Folks, those jokesters in Congress,
yeah.
The clowns.
And there's reasons behind this. For example, gerrymandering is very big in the United States, obviously.
Voter suppression.
And another thing that affects Canada as well is basically the ideological organs of the right, lobby groups and corporations and stuff, are very well organized and very well funded. Whereas the median voter, even if they exist, is not. All they have is their single vote. You have lobbyists who can basically focus in on politicians and get their ear better than any voter could.
A slightly more local example of an issue that doesn't have a clear left or right, or can be very muddled or sort of cuts both ways, I think, is environmentalism and to some degree the Greens as a kind of political project. They, you know, the left-wing joke is that Greens are conservatives
Tories on bicycles.
Yeah, the environment and environmentalism is usually classically associated with the left, but you have at various times seen green parties take like very right-wing positions alongside with that service to environmentalism.
Yeah, you're seeing that the Liberal and Conservative parties in the current federal election in Canada, neither of them really own that issue. And the Canadian media will turn its mics to Elizabeth May and the Green Party, but that party doesn't really have coherent positions and hasn't for a long time. It's basically a very neoliberal centrist party, considering it's a fringe party that doesn't pull in more than, 3 or 4% of the vote. It doesn't really, and has historically had a one or two seats, whether they're elected or not. So they're not as big a player as you would think for the amount of airtime that their leaders get.
Canadians are like very, like surveys show over and over again that overwhelming majorities of Canadians are like very concerned that we're not doing enough about climate change. So this is like something the Greens get to talk about a lot. But the Greens had a slogan recently they put out, neither left nor right, but forward. And if you look at the example of the Greens in BC, where they're in a coalition with the NDP government, Andrew Weaver, their leader, hates teachers' unions. They oppose the NDP's plan to raise the minimum wage because it was bad for small business. They tend to be quite economically right-wing. And on social issues, they're also all over the map. There's a bunch of candidates for the federal Greens who are opposed to abortion, like deeply opposed to it. One of them like ran for the Ontario Greens in 2018 and filled out the Campaign Life Coalition's survey, which is like, if you're filling that out, you're already really right-wing, and saying that he would be in favor of legislating or at least publicly defunding abortion.
One of the things I want to say here is that when we say these are issues that can be either left or right, we're not trying to say that there are not clear left-wing or right-wing positions to take on these issues. Obviously, there's a huge difference in being an environmentalist and doing Malthusian eco-fascism, close the borders, we only have so many resources, we can't share them, and saying, I'm an environmentalist and I believe we need to dismantle capitalism because it is unevenly allocating resources to the global north, which allows imperialism to continue and which like allows like rampant climate change to continue. There's a big difference between being for Brexit because you think Fortress Europe is a racist and reactionary project and the EU just does brutal austerity on countries that step out of line, and being for Brexit because you are just a reactionary xenophobe who thinks immigrants are going to take your jobs. The point of all of this is that being able to stake out very clear and very obvious left and right positions on all of these issues shows that these are areas of immense political contestation that don't really in any way neatly track onto this median voter theorem. And that is the key assumption that is just collapsing around us really visibly and really clearly, and is what is making it so difficult for so many traditional political parties to do politics as they try and kind of get their footing on this new reality.
Yeah, because I don't think the examples that we mentioned, like Brexit or manufacturing jobs in America or climate change, are fringe issues. These are very prominent key issues in every voter's mind, and they do decide elections, and they will.
Absolutely.
Another big assumption is the idea that the radicals on each wing of the spectrum of opinion, as you get further and further away from that big bell curve, the little trailing tails there, this assumption that those tails have nowhere else to go, that they're stuck voting for whatever candidate that approximates their position, that's falling apart as well.
One of the things I think is important to keep in mind here is that this idea of the median voter theorem and this idea that voters on the ends of the political spectrum, of which there are more and more of, don't have any other choices, is that it fails to measure in any way in enthusiasm and how enthusiasm translates into political wins and political losses. So I think being unable to recognize the importance of levels of political enthusiasm and the time and the money people are willing to give is a real failure of this model.
It also ignores how those fringes, when they get ignored, tend to form into separate political entities. I think this is really what you're seeing with the People's Party of Canada and Maxime Bernier. You actually have a political party like shaping up on this like extreme right wing of the political spectrum to soak up the like weird, wacky edge of like conservative voters.
And all the polling says there's at least 5% of Canadian voters who want that. And I would say that there's a bigger constituency for that kind of politics in Canada than we'd like to believe. Particularly, I think what's holding it together, if the Conservatives somehow flame out in this election or afterwards or whatever, the People's Party is going to reap the benefits of that if they stick around.
Or the People's Party of Canada and its extremely racist views are going to be reabsorbed back into the machinery of the Conservative Party of Canada.
Yeah. So basically what the Reform Party and the PCs did in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. This assumption that the radicals on each wing of this spectrum of opinion have nowhere else to go also ignores the fact that you can stake out territory on key issues that might not be key issues at the moment, but at some point they may be an issue that is very much in the political zeitgeist. A great example of this, once again, is Jeremy Corbyn in the United Kingdom. This is a man who's been a Labour MP for quite a while and who was incredibly, incredibly unpopular under New Labour, like voting against the government all the time, being denounced by Tony Blair and the leadership and the cabinet. And yet, when New Labour fell out of fashion, when people began to really fucking hate Tony Blair and how Tony Blair committed Britain to the Iraq War, and the entire coalition and the political circumstances that led to New Labour fell apart, and Jeremy Corbyn was there, he was someone who had already staked out left-wing territory and emerged as a very credible messenger on these topics.
Yeah, or we get Bernie Sanders in the United States, somebody who's definitely sat at the fringes of elected officials for decades, but also for decades he supported universal Medicare. And now the idea of universal Medicare is like very much in vogue in the United States. And who is the most popular politician in the United States? Well, it's Bernie Sanders, because people consider him very, very credible voice on this issue. And so much of like the Democratic establishment with its like piecemeal incremental healthcare reforms that don't actually like get rid of the private for-profit driven US healthcare sector are find themselves basically in a real hard place because they can't convince their own base that this is what they should be doing.
Furthermore, you're seeing that in America, voters are already saturated with the messages from, say, the private for-profit health insurance industry, and yet it's still cutting through to have Medicare for All that's dominating candidate debates for Democratic presidential nominees.
There's also counter examples of this in a way that are maybe not so favorable to political projects that we would like. And I think a really great example of this in Canada is the Greens, because the Greens very much staked out a territory on climate and on the environment before it was really an issue that was so much at the forefront of our politics as it really is today. And this is an example of something that has really, really hurt the left of center or the social democratic left in Canada, because the fact that the Greens are seen as a very credible messenger on the environment and on climate change is absolutely bleeding support away from the NDP right now.
Another example is the People's Party of Canada on the right side of the political spectrum. I mean, a lot of what they say is racist and xenophobic and doesn't seem particularly popular right now, but very grimly, being racist and xenophobic might become really popular, in which case they might...
yeah, it's just cresting in popularity.
In which case they might be a really credible party, which is like really frightening.
The fourth assumption that really makes up median voter theorem that is also crumbling around us is the idea that what really determines elections are the swing voters that live in the middle of the bell curve where all of the votes are. First of all, who the fuck are these people?
These are people that are, you know, socially liberal, but fiscally conservative.
Shut the fuck up.
So to an extent, like, they do exist in the sense that one of the most important things for governments and an incumbent government is basically what is the unemployment rate. So if it's low, governments get reelected. If it's high, they don't. So basically, you have like these people who move from center right to center left semi-regularly over like issues like that. They also tend to be concerned about things like the character of leadership, which most voters don't really care about. If your whole political strategy is to chase only likely voters and not spend any time or a lot of effort trying to mobilize the disenfranchised, it does make sense to just pursue swing voters because they're usually likely to vote and they can be persuaded one way or the other and tend to flip back and forth based on very tiny policy details, even if they're not necessarily policy wonks.
What kind of vision of politics is this? Surely politics is supposed to be as expansive and as all-encompassing and as liberatory as possible. And when all you are doing is chasing after this very narrow sliver of likely voters, you completely miss the opportunity to have politics that are in any way transformative. And it's disgusting. Like, it really does make me sick.
It is definitely one of the most like cynical ways of doing politics is to chase these. I mean, to me, they seem like idiot people. Who has these positions? Who changes their political stripes based on like very few facts?
And like, what's the point? Like, the point is to what? Hold on to your government for one more term so you can do these two or three more tiny piecemeal things, when if you approach politics like it is a liberatory and transformative project, you might only get one chance or one opportunity, but you would actually have the willpower and the organization to do something with it and to change people's lives and to make our world better.
Kate, I think you're alienating all of our socially progressive but economically a little more conservative listeners.
Well, our listeners who are fiscally conservative but socially liberal can eat my ass.
It's important to remember that the same time frame where this chasing the center has been occurring is also when the parties and policies were brought in where we got neoliberalism. The same center chasing is what brought you stagnating wages, climate change, unprecedented income inequality, a bunch of ineffectual politicians and parties that sold you out, et cetera, et cetera. This is also the same center that brought you the idea of an imaginary hidden hand of the market that self-regulates and self-organizes.
A really useful example here is illustrated by Mike Davis in what is a really excellent book called Prisoners of the American Dream. stream. Highly, highly recommend it. And he talks about the depoliticization of the working class that has taken place in the United States, where pretty much a silent majority of the working class sat out more than half of the elections of the last century. So there is basically this mute and incredibly atomized and individualized and alienated proletariat that exists in the imperial core of one of the most powerful countries that has ever existed in the world. And it also correlates directly with this very striking absence of an independent political party that has in any way claiming or attempting to represent labor.
I was leafing through the book, and at this one point, talking about what happened to working class, what happened to like left-wing voters or working class voters, he writes about this period in the 70s where you had like voter participation start to really, really drop amongst this population. Just quoting from the book here, voter participation, which had been relatively stable for more than 20 years, suddenly underwent a sharp decline. Studies of voting behavior during the 1970s uncovered the astonishing dropout of 18 million former voters as distinguished from the never voted segments of the potential electorate. So you had people just like stop voting because they're like, oh, it doesn't matter. The choices are Pepsi or Coke. No matter who you vote for, like they're not going to be representing me.
So you get this phenomenon where what we call politics has become depoliticized. It no longer becomes a site for conflict or disagreement or for various interests to hash out their different visions of society in the future. The range of what gets talked about, what can be contested, and what can be up for debate becomes incredibly narrow, in part because everyone is focusing on converting centrist swing voters for the next election.
What ends up happening is that focusing so narrowly on minutiae, there's very little opportunity to talk about anything of substance, so people check out. If you're chasing centrist votes and you're talking about whatever centrist voters are concerned with that week, you know, and you've been working a dead-end job or your wages have stagnated for a decade, like that doesn't really compel you to go out to the ballot box.
This is something that I have really noticed in any of the organizing work that I've done, is that people have incredibly limited political horizons and they have incredibly limited ideas of what political action is. So people can very easily identify the ways in which politics impacts their lives. They can very easily identify the problems in their lives, and they can very easily identify who is causing them. But the problem is when you say, okay, like, what are we going to do about it? You will so often get people who are completely stuck on, like, we should all write letters to our MLA, or we should remind the media or remind decision makers that X, Y, and Z decision is actually bad for X, Y, and Z reason. So this idea of politics as the realm of conflict is just so far beyond how most people conceptualize politics. And it's no coincidence that none of the things I mentioned are ever going to work, and they will never have you win.
You get the situation where politics gets turned into policy discussions, where it's, you know, it's a realm where only experts and economists weigh in. Talking heads on TV or whatever becomes too complex for mere mortals like you and I to comprehend, so for ordinary citizens to judge.
So it becomes more about policing and maintaining the existing order, keeping things going so that nothing fundamentally has to change.
Here's the thing. Politics means exposing conflicts, and it means making conflicts explicit. That is what politics is. And a lot of people think that politics is an act of compromise, or it is an act of conclusion that you come to through discussion and through negotiation. But that is all secondary to the original thing. And the original thing is conflict. Like, not to be extremely back on my own bullshit, but the owning class and the working class have nothing in common. And between these two classes, a struggle must take place. That is the core of politics. That is what is at stake here. That is what is going on.
Yeah. I mean, they're just like fundamentally opposed interests in society that have very different visions of how the future should look. And those different interests have to go to war with each other.
Yeah.
Or like, are at war with each other basically all the time.
It's just we're losing.
Yeah. Or that gets papered over, or it gets, subdued so that nobody really talks about it or it doesn't get said out loud.
Let's say I am a licensed practical nurse and I work in an extended care facility, and I want there to be more people on shift with me because my job is difficult and because the patients we are taking care of deserve better care. That desire is fundamentally at odds with the ability of the person who privately owns that extended care facility to make money and to return profit to their shareholders. And you can try and pave that over and smooth that over all you like, but at the end of the day, those things are fundamentally at odds with each other, and there is going to be conflict. How that conflict is mediated, that is what is politics.
Yeah, and we saw kind of a sort of like subsumed version of it during the Alberta election, because there was like some discussion around and debate around the fact that we have to balance the budget, but also that the Conservatives want to deliver huge corporate tax cuts. So basically, Albertans are concerned about their public services, but this is then put up against the Conservatives' desire and, well, interest in delivering huge corporate tax cuts to the class that they represent. And we're going to see when this budget drops and what the cuts are going to look like. And essentially, you're going to see this conflict made like real in the form of what the budget will be.
Yeah. So I think during the election, voters may have been presented that vision of tinkering so that you have, you know, how much budget do you want and how you can adjust that based on numbers that are abstract from people's lives. But with the actual budget coming out, like people are going to feel that impact, and it's going to be in the realms of their healthcare, their school. Like they're already seeing things that aren't being announced, or
people are going to die as a result of budget cuts. So Suncor can and already has done share buybacks. Like this is how the conflict is happening. But we only talked about it in the election in like very abstract terms, as like, oh, how are we going to balance the budget if you cut corporate taxes?
Exactly.
Social murder is murder. The thing about conflict is that conflict is good and conflict is normal.
People are generally not equipped with the language to have political disagreements, because often this means that people who do politics and have competing or alternate visions get depicted as having a difficult personality. I mean, like, personally, doing politics, getting up in like forums to ask like politicians questions, or like going to a protest, I mean, that gives me like some anxiety and like makes me nervous. And I do politics. Like, I'm interested and have like, and I understand that politics is conflict, and it still like makes me uncomfortable. And imagine all the people who have been like kind of depoliticized having to engage with this now.
A lot of the time, particularly in this day and age, doing politics means like transgressing some sort of norm. You're making things difficult, or you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're jamming things up somehow. But that's actually what is to be done. That is an important task at the present moment.
We are socialized to not like participating in conflict and to feel bad. And if you've ever interacted with, say, the cops at a protest or a sit-in or an occupation, they will use that language. They will act like you are being unreasonable and childish and immature and throwing a wrench into things. And it is like, yeah, I am throwing a wrench into things. That's what politics is. That is the nature of politics. That is conflict. And you are made to feel very, very uncomfortable for participating in these things. Rory is like absolutely correct. I think this is a shared sentiment among many of us here on Team Advantage, is that, yeah, like it's incredibly anxiety inducing to go to a protest or to phone bank a list of strangers or to stand outside a workplace and hand people leaflets or to zip tie yourself to a door. Like all of these things are uncomfortable. They are not like fun, happy experiences to go do, but they are the very, very nature of politics. And then you think that most people have been socialized to a point where even something like going to a march or going to like a state sanctioned protest is completely out of their lived experience and out of their day-to-day lives and is in fact seen as transgressive, very much a repoliticization of what we think of as politics is crucial.
So even among groups of friends or colleagues or comrades, this dynamic means being able to disagree and spell out your reasons and arguments and evaluate them and assess critique of them.
And to give you a bit of a peek behind the Alberta Advantage curtain, this is absolutely the process that goes into creating our podcast. And this podcast is a political project and these episodes. And it might seem like when you listen to it that there's some kind of line or Alberta Advantage line, but if there is one, that type of thing is only developed through really rigorous disagreement with one another. It's pretty common for us in a podcast recording for me to turn off the recording for 15, 20 minutes while we'll have it out over a disagreement we have about some topic. And that's like really important to do. We don't always agree on these things, and we strengthen and develop our own politics through conflict with one another.
Struggle sessions are the secret ingredient to the Alberta Advantage.
Sometimes a family is six podcasters who are constantly struggle sessioning each other.
That's pretty much our lives, but yes.
So one of the things that's also related to like that depoliticization is this psychologization of politics that I've kind of noticed in the way, and this is really prevalent in the United States, the way that a way of conceiving and talking about politics in terms of like, well, liberals are like, their brains are just like more open to change and novelty, and conservatives, their brains are more about sameness and tradition and that sort of thing. but it sort of just pretends that these political positions just like evolved out of like, you know, the primordial soup. In a sense, people's psychological makeups are going to affect individually, like sort of how people will engage with politics and like what sort of things do appeal to them. But the actual political positions and that we fight over are like these material interests that create this antagonism within society are based on not psychology, but the way that society itself is structured intentionally. The idea, like whether or not you think corporate tax cuts are a good idea, like this is a left or right issue, but that doesn't mean you're just psychologically more amenable to like thinking corporate tax cuts are good. Like that makes no sense. We want to go back to like hunter-gatherer stuff. There weren't corporations and tax cuts to think about. Like, so that it has nothing to do with their psychological makeup. It has so much to do with the way society is structured.
Our material reality did not fall out of the sky. Our politics did not fall out of the sky. The political positions and terrain we are currently dealing with did not just fall out of the sky. All of it is contested territory. All of it is made. All of it can be unmade.
And all these things are backed by arguments, right? Like there have to be arguments made in favor of corporate tax cuts in order for them to happen. They don't just fall from the sky, and which means like there can be counter arguments made. And part of the problem with politics is that the people with the megaphones saying corporate tax cuts are good, very well funded, very huge megaphones, whereas people saying maybe not such a good idea, there are less of us and we're less well equipped. Nevertheless, it's important to remember also that if you're any type of organization that like has a kind of external politics that aims to like have political effects externally, you have to have internal processes to also be able to deal with conflict, deal in a structured kind of way, and to be able to process and those conflicts and the arguments between competing visions and make something out of them so that you can move forward. In some like activist spaces and in some political circles, because people are friends and because people conceive of themselves as being amongst allies, it's often there's almost like more pressure to not bring up conflict or not bring up disagreement, which I think leads to a pretty bad internal culture of politics, which I think contributes to a very poor external type of politics.
So in conclusion, stop chasing the center. Our society is increasingly experiencing a repoliticization of large amounts of people who were completely checked out of politics. And these could be people who were checked out of politics for any number of reasons, whether from deindustrialization, voter disenfranchisement, just flat out not seeing anything they wanted or any of the problems in their lives being reflected in the political sphere. But the fact of the matter is that many, many people are checking back in to politics. And if the left does not explain society to them, other people will, and we will live under ecofascism.
Yeah, a lot of these people that have been historically disenfranchised, they're angry now. And if you don't have an explanation for what has contributed to their anger, I can guess that Maxime Bernier will come up with an explanation and it's going to be bad.
In conclusion, please, from the friendly folks here at Team Advantage, just do fucking politics.
Get in fights.
Do it. Do some politics. Have disagreements. Articulate your arguments. Evaluate the criticism. It's fun.
Talk to others. Persuade them.
Fight.
Get into fist fights.
Get into fisticuffs.
Fisticuffs.
That's what Karen's saying.
Yes, I'm actually saying
intellectually fisticuffs.
No, physically as well.
Buy a gun.
All right. On behalf of all of us here at the Alberta Advantage,
buy a gun.
Buy a gun. No. Bye.
Okay, we can't say that. We can't say on behalf of us.
It's a totally legal thing.
Why? No. Do you want to say that to a judge? Makes no difference. I go.
Let's do it.
The Alberta Advantage is part of a loose affiliation of left-wing podcasts hosted by the bilingual journalism collective Ricochet, who you can find at ricochet.media. Our podcast is primarily supported through Patreon by listeners like you. We use the money for equipment and other semi-serious pursuits. And as a thank you, we send out fun packages with grain elevator-themed stickers and weird tote bags a couple times a year. You can support us at patreon.com/albertaadvantage. Thanks so much for listening, and take care out there. Stone Town, I know.